For the week of September 4th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 117, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And not at the U.S. Open Tennis Center, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, that's right. You've been watching tennis all week and all weekend, but you're not there today because it's raining, or is there another tornado or hurricane?
Hurricane, flood, plague, locust. Yes, it's raining, and they've canceled the entire day session. I had four tickets. I had three guests going with me, so I'm a little bummed.
So you're a big tennis fan then?
Oh, huge tennis fan. I'm a big tennis family.
Oh, okay. Well, then that explains it. Now, we had a bit of a contentious pre-show. So I can tell you that on today's show, we will be arguing a lot. In fact, we'll be arguing over a number of issues, including this past summer's record-breaking box office. We'll also be duking it out over the state of reality television. During Inside Baseball, I think we'll probably agree on a lot of stuff. We'll try to tell you why Netflix and Stars aren't getting along, though. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
This weekend's box office is a bit of a hybrid. We have the four-day Labor Day weekend here in North America, and we have three-day grosses from the rest of the world. So it's sort of a mishmash of figures, but here are the numbers as best as we can figure them out. The number one movie around the world this weekend was Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which grossed $29.6 million worldwide. It's at $350 million total. At number two is The Smurfs, which is on fire. It grossed another $29 million worldwide. It's at $429 million and counting. And number three is the big news in the U.S., The Help, which grossed another $20.3 million, including money it made in Australia. It's beginning its campaign around the world. It's made $123 million worldwide total. It's been number one at the box office for 3 weeks in a row in the U.S. It's a big, big success story.
Right. We should say this week it made $14.6 million in North America, $20.3 million worldwide.
It made $18.3 million in North America, including the Monday box office figures.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, that's where all the confusion comes in. I had to go to three or four different sources to figure it out because some people had the weekend numbers, some people had the Monday numbers as well, some people had overseas numbers, but there you go. $20 million around the world, mostly in the U.S., the number one movie in the country. It's a great success story. And number four is Final Destination 5, which grossed another $18.7 million. It's just at about $100 million worldwide and counting. At number five is The Debt, a Holocaust thriller. Starring Helen Mirren. It's a remake of an Israeli film, I believe. It grossed $14.6 million. It opened in the U.S. and Russia.
That seems rather strange to say, a Holocaust thriller.
Well, it's a thriller with a Holocaust sort of background embedded in its in the plot twist. It's not like it's set during the Holocaust.
Right.
At number six is Shark Night 3D, another film that opened in North America and Russia. It grossed $12.9 million worldwide. And number seven, finally, was Apollo 18, a sort of mockumentary, not a mockumentary, but a faux documentary thriller that had been sitting on the shelf for ages. The studio had changed the release date five or six or seven times. They didn't screen it for critics. You knew this was not a good movie. So they got to be kind of happy that they grossed $10.7 million. At least they made something out of it so far in the first weekend. That will undoubtedly drop fast and hard. And number eight is Colombiana, one of the movies that opened last week. It stars Zoe Saldana. It actually held pretty well, the best of any movie that opened last week. It grossed $9.4 million. It's at $22 million total. Certainly not a success. At number nine is Cowboys and Aliens, another $9 million worldwide. It's not even quite at $150 million total around the world and counting. At number 10 is Horrible Bosses. That grossed $8.1 million worldwide. It's at just under $180 million and counting. Number 11, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, another $7.9 million. It's at $1.32 billion worldwide, one of the highest grossing films of all time, of course. And then there's Our Idiot Brother, Spy Kids, and Cars 2, all of which made a little bit of money. The most interesting movie down at the bottom of the list is The Inbetweeners. It's a British film. It made $6.5 million. It's basically open in the UK only. It's made a terrific $56 million so far. I want you to remember it because it's a sitcom turned into a movie, probably the most successful in years to do that in the UK. It was three seasons on television. The first season, it got like 300,000 viewers. Then the next season, it got like 800,000 viewers. And then the third season, it got like 2 million viewers. I mean, it really grew and grew and grew. Now they've turned it into a movie. It's about teenagers living their dull lives in the suburbs. Big hit in the UK. MTV is already remaking the TV series for the US, just like they did with Skins. And so we'll have to see how this turns out. But a big success at the box office for The Inbetweeners.
Well, speaking of success, I know you wanted to talk about this past summer's box office, as you know, you say it was a record-setting box office, not only here in North America, but also around the world.
Well, I don't say it. It's a fact.
Well, yeah, I should say, you're quoting The Hollywood Reporter.
That's right. But, you know, as we say so often, all you ever hear is gloom and doom about the box office. Nobody's going to the movies. They're not selling any tickets. It's just ridiculous. But I realize the only time they say positive things is when it's a new record that's been set. If this year's the highest grossing year of all time, they'll say things are great. If it's the second or third highest grossing year of all time, they'll say, oh, no, it's not making as much money as we did 2 years ago or something like that. So, yeah, this was a great summer at the box office for Hollywood. Here in North America, movies grossed $4.3 billion. Overseas, it grossed $8.2 billion in the same period. That's $12.5 billion worldwide for the summer season. That's how Showbiz Sandbox would talk about it. $12 billion in the May to August summer box office bonanza. That's a lot of money.
Well, generally between Memorial Day, which is at the end of May in North America, and Labor Day, which was just this past weekend, the North American box office makes 40% of its revenue for the entire year. So that's why the summer season is so important.
That's right. And this year we edged out last year to be the highest grossing summer season of all time. Last year, of course, overall was the second biggest box office year of all time. So even if we fall below last year, we could be the third biggest grossing box office year of all time, which would still, in my mind, be pretty good.
Well, yes, we did go up. Of course, Hollywood.com is pointing out that we went up by less than 1%. So they're saying, yes.
Over the second biggest year of the, over the biggest box office summer of all time.
Right.
We set a new box office record and they're saying, yeah, but it's only by 1%.
I'm just stating the facts.
That's why I'm saying their narrow negative attitude towards the box office is so wrong.
You know, while you're pointing out, and The Hollywood Reporter is pointing out, that it was a record-setting summer, both here in the U.S. and overseas, the New York Times and Brooks Barnes is pointing out, well, neither Smurf nor Wizard could save summer movie attendance. Now, the key word in that sentence or headline is attendance, because, of course, we just talked about how revenue and grosses are up, but attendance continues to decline. Now, earlier this year, the industry, at least in North America, was down 20% in ticket sales, movie attendance, not box office. And now, after the summer, we're only down 4% for the year. So you were right, Michael, that, you know, attendance would continue to climb throughout the summer.
Right. We're down from lag 4% from last year.
4% year over
year. From last year, the second highest grossing year of all time. Again, if you say, well, this week compared to this week last year, or this summer compared to last year, take the bigger picture. Box office ticket sales, attendance, has risen every decade since the 70s. I have every reason to believe, since we're just about to have the second or third biggest year of all time, that the 2010s will be another decade in which ticket sales will increase over the previous decade. Every decade since the 70s, ticket sales have gone up. This decade will do the same damn thing once everything is said and done. People who were screaming about how horrible the year was in the first quarter now have to realize ticket sales are just about even. If we have a couple good movies in the fall and winter, guess what? We'll have a great year. You've got to look at the big picture, and that's what they never do.
Well, looking at the big picture, it's looking as if North America attendance, which is sliding, at least over the past 2 years, is really becoming just another territory within the worldwide release pattern and worldwide release strategy for a Hollywood big blockbuster, because now these films are grossing more overseas, and they have for some time, but now the North American box office is becoming way less important than it used to be.
Well, it's important in the sense that it sets the standard. Typically, a movie that does really well here has a much better shot at doing well overseas. You know, obviously, it doesn't work for every movie, but success here helps launch a movie elsewhere. So it's just like a Broadway show helps launch the touring production. You know, you have a big hit on Broadway, people want to go see it when they're in Chicago or Minneapolis. So a movie's a hit in North America, it's going to more likely do well. Like The Help, for example, is very well positioned to sort of break through and do well overseas where it might not have otherwise, because it was such a big hit here in the U.S. And of course, big movies open everywhere at the same time.
Right. China looks like it will actually break the $2 billion box office record, at least in 2011. Russia also a big player now. And Brooks Barnes says here, then this speaks to the attendance issue, Hollywood has now experienced four consecutive summers of eroding attendance, a cause for alarm for both studios and the publicly traded theater chains. One or two soft years can be dismissed as an aberration. Four signal real trouble.
You're talking about ticket sales. Well, that's not true. We don't have 4 years of sliding ticket sales.
Well, that's what the New York Times is reporting. Summer sales, not whole year sales.
No,
summer.
But we don't care whether a movie's released in April or November or July. That doesn't matter to us. You know, we're not obsessed with a quarter-to-quarter comparison or a week-to-week comparison. I don't care that this Memorial Day, or this is Labor Day, I always forget.
Labor Day.
This is Labor Day. I don't forget that Labor Day is down from last year, or it's the lowest Labor Day attendance in 15 years or whatever. Who cares?
Well, let's look at some of the movies that were helping break records at the summer box office on a gross basis. This New York Times piece also points out that, you know, just because on Stranger Tides, the Pirates of the Caribbean latest installment made over $1 billion, Disney had to spend a fortune to get it out there. They probably spent around $400 million in production costs and marketing costs all over the world. And that leaves profit rather thin when you think that $500 million of that at least is going to theaters. They're going to wind up with $500 million to split and cover their costs.
Is half to theater owners, is that about right now still? Because I mean, the number is very, because I thought like first week in the studios got more like 80 or 90%, and it slides down as the movie stays in theaters longer and longer.
Well, I can tell you that there are some studio executives that would love to hear that they could get 80%. They never really do.
No, for the first weekend.
No,
second
no,
weekend, I mean, third 80, weekend. It doesn't happen anymore?
No, it totally does not happen. They try. Plus, the 90-10 splits don't work anymore. The house allowances are pretty much gone. Yeah. There's usually an aggregate, which is somewhere between 50 and 60% going to the studio.
But don't forget now that that $1 billion that Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides made, that's just the beginning. Disney also has a stake in merchandise sales. It has a stake in the rides at the theme parks. It has a stake in the DVD sales, the stake in it being shown on the Disney Channel, and on and on and on. So they've got toys and games and merchandise. It's a very successful franchise. I wouldn't think that the box, you don't want it to be a lost leader, but I wouldn't think that the box office is the end of the story.
No, I mean, even if this film lost money or broke even, Disney wins.
Yeah,
because
you had three movies that grossed $1 billion this summer: Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part Two, Transformers: Dark Side of the Moon, and Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. Three big success. Those are three of the biggest grossing movies of all time, obviously.
Yeah, it's funny because I was doing a little math, and the average box office take for blockbusters this summer was $708.6 or $7 million. So over $700 million was the average blockbuster box office take, but that's because Harry Potter, Transformers, Pirates of the Caribbean really skewed and messed with the numbers a bit. Because you go to Kung Fu Panda 2 and you got $650 million worldwide.
That's right. The Hangover 2, that's the biggest success story as far as the cost. It made $576 million worldwide and the budget was only $80 million.
Right. And I did a little bit more math, which is not necessarily my strong suit. But if you look at the cost of these movies, or the reported cost of these movies, you are basically saying that the cost of all of the movies that were produced, and we're talking about Captain America, Planet of the Apes, Smurfs, Cars 2, Hangover 2, Kung Fu Panda 2, Pirates of the Caribbean, Transformers, and Harry Potter, the second one, that you pretty much spent $1.37 billion making them. Let's double it for argument's sake, okay? Let's just say it cost $3.5 billion to make and market these films worldwide. Well, if you add up the grosses for all of the films that I just mentioned, you actually get to $6.4 billion. So you're still, you know, it's almost a 2-to-1 ratio there.
You're still taking home $3 billion. That's feeling pretty good.
Yeah, that's not bad, actually. So we're not arguing as much as I thought we would about this. I mean, really, we're just talking about, hey, we would love to get more people going to the movies.
Well, no, they are going to the movies. Box office attendance has grown every year, every decade, since the 70s. People went to bought more movie tickets in the 2000s than they did in the 90s, 80s, or 70s. They will buy more tickets in the 2010s. It's 2011. We only have 2 years. They will spend more money in this decade. Trust me.
But to Brooks Barnes' point, okay, just let's kind of take this from an objective standpoint. And let's look at it from, say, a publisher's standpoint.
He's looking at just the summer season.
Right. Now, he's looking at just the summer season.
That's
correct.
Silly. That's silly. Who cares when a movie is released? Thor came out in the spring. Bridesmaids came out in the spring. Thor made more than Captain America and, to date, Rise of the Planet Apes and the Smurfs, too. And the Smurfs. So, great. Thor made $448 million worldwide. It came out in April. Who cares?
Well, much like, you know, you would care about, gee, do we do well in Russia with action films or do we do better in North America? As a distributor, you would then begin to tweak your release pattern. Well, you know what? These studio executives are also looking at, gee, we don't do well with, I don't know, romances in the summer, so let's hold that for the fall. So that's really where that kind of thinking comes into play. But I also think what Brooks Barnes is trying to point out here is that it's somewhat of a trend, and that could point possibly, not definitely, to a problem. Now, if we look at the same thing in publishing, you see more and more ebooks outselling hardback books or traditional print books, and I think that it's safe to say that that's probably a trend that's going to continue. So again, when you're looking at trends, we're hoping that this is not a trend that will continue, that this is just, you know, 4 years of a downward trend, and we'll have 5 years of an upward trend during the summer.
Well, if you randomly pick 3 months, the story of the box office is not the downward trend in the summer. It's the upward trend in February and March and April and August. We had a record, you know, and September, months that were not months where there were high box office grosses before. Hollywood has now learned to program movies 12 months a year. So looking at three random months chosen in the middle of the summer is stupid. And the dependence on the summer blockbuster is less and less, because in the spring you had Thor and Bridesmaids and Rio, all of which were big hits, and a lot of other movies. And that's the trend that you look at. And if you look at the entire year, there is no trend of decreasing ticket sales. There's a long-term trend of increased ticket sales every single decade. So if you want to say, but in June, with the last three Junes, we sold fewer tickets, I'll say, who cares? Ticket sales are increasing decade by decade, and they have been. They've been keeping pace with population. They've been keeping pace with the growth of the industry. We've got much more box office around the world, and people are also buying movies on DVD and streaming them and doing all sorts of other ways of consuming movies.
Well, let me ask you this. If I said year over year or decade over decade, more people bought books, print books, decade over decade from the 70s, 80s, 90s, the aughts, and you know that trend will probably continue in the 2010s, would you say that's correct? Because the short-term trend, is not the case.
I don't know what you're asking there. The book industry is segueing to, the format is segueing to digital rather than print, but they don't care. It's cheaper to create a digital format, so they hope it goes to digital more quick because they make more money off it, or they should or could, depending on the pricing, how much people pay, and how they get it to them.
Right, and I guess what we're arguing about,
people are buying
is
books just as much. It doesn't matter whether they go in April or August. They're going to movies just as much. It doesn't matter whether they're going in April or August. They're buying books just as much. Total book sales are huge. It's a $20 billion industry. It doesn't matter whether they're buying them in audio or print or ebook. They are buying books. So if you look at print sales, what you'll do, Brooke Barnes might say, oh my God, print sales are down, and ignore the fact that ebook sales are up. He's saying, okay, the June and July was down, and ignoring the fact that sales in August and April were up.
Well, I guess what we're really debating here is the importance of trend analysis and how wide a sample you take when doing trend analysis.
That's right. Some of the other big hits in the summer, which were not big blockbusters, but they were made cheaply and made a lot of money. Super 8 grossed $245 million worldwide. Bad Teacher grossed $200 million. Horrible Bosses, $180 million. The Help is at $123 million and counting. Woody Allen's movie Midnight in Paris grossed $95 million. You know, there are a lot of hits.
That's true.
Came out this summer.
And there were some bombs. I mean, you have Cowboys and Aliens, which made it cost $163 million and has made $96 in the U.S., not worldwide.
That's right. And $150 million worldwide. It's barely made its budget back, so that's a disaster. Green Lantern has grossed $214 million. It cost $200 million to make. Even The Change-Up, the Ryan Reynolds, Jason Bateman movie, that cost $52 million to make. It's only grossed $40 million. There's Conan the Barbarian.
That's got to be the biggest disaster, Conan the Barbarian. It costs $90 million to make it, and in the U.S. it's only made $20 million.
It's certainly, you know, a flop. $90 million isn't a huge ticket, but it's a lot. But we have to see how it does overseas. I assume it won't do that great, but who knows?
Yeah, I mean, the average cost of the 10 movies that I mentioned previously, where I was doing all that math, the average cost of those movies, production-wise, was $152 million. So it's not cheap to make a big blockbuster movie.
That's right. And, you know, speaking of not being cheap to make them, we were having a discussion before about The Lone Ranger, which Disney said, oh my God, we can't make it. It's too expensive.
That's
and
right.
I was puzzled
yeah.
because they said, it's $240 million. We can't possibly make it for that. You have to get the budget down to $215, to which I thought, really? $25 million is the difference between whether you're going to make money or not on this movie?
Possibly. I mean, we were talking about this a couple of episodes ago.
Yeah. But it turns out that what they were upset about probably wasn't the budget.
Oh, really? What were they upset about then?
the back-end participation. And you hinted that in Pirates of the Caribbean, that, you know, they'll make this money, they'll take back $500 million from the box office, but then they got to pay Johnny Depp his back-end and Gore Verbinski and Jerry Bruckheimer. They have the same problem with this movie. The back-end deals are so expensive that they looked at the numbers and said, even if it makes $700 million, right, we're not going to get any money out of it. Why are we rolling the dice on this movie when our upside at best is probably, you know, a sliver of what it should be?
That's right. I mean, when you look at movies such as The Help, which doesn't have any big name stars, I mean, you know, it's got some up-and-comers and some people that have been on the front cover of magazines lately, but not Julia Roberts and Tom Hanks, like Larry Crown, which didn't do well at the box office, or Cowboys and Aliens, you have, you know, Harrison Ford and Daniel Craig in that film. All of these big box office stars don't seem to be guaranteeing grosses. And so when that's the case, you don't want to be giving them profit participation.
Well, but they're doing that more and more. But they're saying what they're wanting is they're not going to get the upfront numbers. Johnny Depp won't get $20 million out of the box, but this is not going to be able to keep them out of the back end. A quote from one person who told the Hollywood Reporter is, you know, that now that the producers turned around and said, fine, we'll make it $250 million, and they trimmed this and that, and they did it. And Disney is sort of feeling, uh-oh, we'll have to make the movie now. And this producer said, quote, if that's the number, they'll make it. Johnny Depp won't get $20 million. Gore Verbinski won't get $10 million. Jerry won't get his fee, and they won't get first dollar gross. But if the movie works, they'll make even more money than they would have.
Right, and it's unlike you know, the average movie star or someone who is up and coming. When a film like Pirates of the Caribbean or maybe even The Lone Ranger earns $1 billion and Johnny Depp makes public, hey, I was supposed to get some back end here and didn't, the studio usually coughs some up. And you saw that with Avatar and Titanic and Lord of the Rings, all with the directors there saying, hey, I'm not seeing any profit participation. And
they had to take him to court.
Right. But eventually, and they won. The directors won.
Yeah, I mean, the Lord of the Rings people sued. I don't know about the other movies. I don't know if James Cameron sued, but they had to sue to get their money.
Yeah, you're right about that. Lord of the Rings, Peter Jackson had to sue. Jim Cameron just had to kind of make it public that he wasn't receiving any back end, and all of a sudden he received a check for $100 million.
Right. Disney's maybe feeling a little wary because it has a couple big ticket items. One is Oz the Great and Powerful, which is a prequel to The Wizard of Oz, starring James Franco and Mila Kunis and directed by Sam Raimi, who did all the Spider-Man movies. That's a $200 million movie. Then next spring, they have John Carter of Mars, starring Taylor Kitsch of Friday Night Lights. It's the live-action debut of a Pixar veteran, director Andrew Stanton. He did Finding Nemo. That's budgeted at $250 million. They insist, even though other people say it costs more. So they're nervous about those movies, and they're thinking, golly, do we want to do The Lone Ranger as well? To which I'd say, as far as those three movies, I think The Lone Ranger with Johnny Depp is a far better roll of the dice than those other two. I mean, I'm excited about seeing all three of them, but The Lone Ranger to me seems a much easier sell.
Right. Now, I would agree with you on that. It is, you know, it's got a built-in audience with both Johnny Depp and The Lone Ranger being an entity or a brand that everybody recognizes. You know, but I think it's not bad that, you know, these studios are turning to these stars and they're saying, look, if the film does well, you do well. So we're not going to pay you $20 million up front, but we're all in this together. And if everybody succeeds here, you're going to make your payday.
Right. Somebody said, you know, used to get outside investors to lay off the cost of making a movie. You know, you'd say, all right, you'd go to France or Germany or some outside company and say, hey, you put up $50 million, you have a piece of this film. Now, apparently, the outside investor is the star.
That's right. That's exactly right. They are basically holding some of the paper on these productions because at $150 million, you know, every penny begins to count because you're trying to bring these budgets down, especially, and bring down the risk as well.
That's right. And I think that's a better way to go. I'd rather give up most of my upfront fee and get a bigger piece in the back end. But you want to make sure the studio has enough on the back end to actually make money. They looked at the formula on Lone Ranger and said, even if it works and grows $700 million, we're only going to make blah, 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 $100 million.
Right. Maybe but I mean, think about it.
That's the figure that they came up with. And they said, gee, that doesn't seem right.
But I mean, think about it. You can understand why some of these stars don't necessarily trust the studios to do the accounting properly when all of a sudden, you know, $900 million movie like a Harry Potter is in the red.
But none of this has to do with net profits. They're not talking about that. They're talking about
gross,
you know,
profits.
Once a movie's made $400 million, we get 10% of it. You know, they're not talking about net profits or any of that bull. You know, this is a whole different area. So they get their money. It's not like where the movie's going to be constantly, you know, in debt and therefore they never get a penny.
Right. Well, I can tell you that some movies that didn't cost $200 million or $150 million were screened over this past weekend and over the past week at both the Telluride Film Festival and the Venice Film Festival. We might want to cover this maybe next week. Certainly these two festivals, along with Toronto, they kick off the fall awards season.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of fun movies. I'm not going to Toronto this year. I was thinking about it, but I just don't have the time. And I'm going to be missing a lot of good movies. At Telluride, they had The Descendants, the new film by Alexander Payne. That stars George Clooney, got great reviews. I would have loved to see the Martin Scorsese movie, a documentary about George Harrison of the Beatles. That's one I'm really sorry I missed. And Steve McQueen, who did the movie, whoops, my head is blanking.
Hunger.
Hunger, very good movie. His new movie, Shame, got a lot of good buzz. So there's always really good movies at these festivals. And certainly an acting standout was Glenn Close. She starred in a film about a woman who dresses as a man in 19th century Dublin in order to get a job. So she's doing an accent, she's doing a period piece, and she's playing another gender. So baby, Oscar's going to come calling.
Yeah, should we just like walk her on stage now, or do we have to wait and watch all the films?
No, the nomination is assured. I haven't seen the movie. I don't know how toweringly good it is, but it certainly is a hot bet to get a nomination.
Well, Steve McQueen's Shame did get a lot of press, mostly because of its, I guess, nudity and its shocking content value. It's about a sex addict. But another performance that was praised was Michael Fassbender's.
Yeah,
in that
he's
film.
A terrific actor.
Yeah, and George Clooney also got raves for The Descendants. He was over in Venice earlier in the week showing his directorial, I don't want to say it's a debut, but it's his third directorial effort, Ides of March, which is based on Farragut North, the play?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah, and that's
It's a political drama.
Right. Madonna's film, We, also screened there to, well, I would say mixed to negative reviews.
Yeah, no, it didn't get great reviews, unfortunately, but that's what happens at festivals.
Yeah, I mean, she directed this film. I think it's her second or maybe third film that she's directed, and she's just hoping that the critics don't kill the film. I think they already have, though.
But Michael Fassbender was also in a David Cronenberg film called A Dangerous Method, so he's really got a good year for himself lined up.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we'll be seeing him come Oscar time.
And yeah, we'll be seeing these movies. They'll be coming out in the fall and the spring and next summer and fall. They'll be coming out for the next year to come. That's what happens when you see movies at Venice and Telluride and Toronto. They lead up to the Oscars or their stuff that comes out over the next year. I know that the Scorsese documentary about George Harrison will be, I believe, on HBO at some point.
Yes. And I can tell you, Telluride is such a great festival. It's so, you know, remote and it's small and you get to talk to the filmmakers and everybody's milling about. It's a really great festival. It only announces its lineup a day or two ahead of time. And it usually has, I mean, I've seen, what have I seen there? Slumdog Millionaire was a film I've seen there. So, you know, they usually have an Oscar winner or two among their programming.
Cool. It sounds like a great fest. I've never been there.
Definitely worth going. Now, we're going to move on to television news. Now, this is a topic that I know Michael and I fought a lot about, whether we should include this or not, because it's really kind of, in a way, a no-brainer. You'd think, you know, reality television is reality television. How could you call it fiction? Well, there was an article or opinion piece in the New York Times written by Virginia Heffernan, who really is saying, look, reality television needs reformation, and it needs to be reformed in some way. And this was in light of Russell Armstrong's suicide on August 15th, and he was a part of The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. And I guess really what she's trying to say is, you know, these characters that are created by producers for reality television, there's a lot of pressure on them in the real world that they bring their lives into these series, sometimes naively, often naively, and really what they bring out of it is mostly loss.
What do you mean most people who appear on reality television lose?
Well, yeah, I mean, much like she said something about game shows, like game show contestants, most reality participants lose. And on
They don't lose. They get to be on TV. Game show contestants are fine. You're on The Price is Right. Just because you don't win the Showcase Showdown, you don't go home thinking I'm a loser. You go home and go, oh my God, I can't wait to see myself on The Price is Right. And you wait and you watch the show and you get to see yourself on TV. Or you even get to see yourself in the audience and they're thrilled. So they don't lose.
So, and I'm just clarifying, what you're saying here is that if you are on Survivor, and let's say you get kicked off the island in the second or third episode, you're really not a loser because technically you were part of the show to begin with. Out of millions of people that could have participated, it came down to you and 32 other people or 16 other people. And so, you know what? You're still a winner in the end.
You got to be on TV. That's what you wanted. You didn't necessarily get to become a star and you know, be on People magazine covers and have your own spin-off show, but that's not necessarily the standard for everyone. You know, getting to be on a game show is a win. The idea that if you don't win at all, that you're somehow a loser is wrong. You're on reality television. Your life isn't, most people don't go on reality TV and have their life damaged because they're on reality TV. Virginia Heffernan goes in the article to say, oh, the Real Housewives series has documented 8 divorces or something like that. I'm making the figure up. Well, out of how many marriages and big deal?
Right. So you're saying, again, you know, we need to look at the sample and when we're doing our trend analysis here.
Right. The idea that they got divorced because they were on the show. Well, you know, half of all marriages end in divorce. Is there any indication that these people wouldn't have gotten a divorce if they hadn't been on a reality show, that that's the sole cause of them being divorced? You know, their jobs ended or their careers flamed out or this or that went wrong. Yeah, that happens. That happens on the show. It happens in life.
Well, you know, she says here that she long believed that reforming reality television would cost the vaudeville genre its freaky and subversive status as a fact-fiction hybrid, that it would lose all the surprises, comic and dramatic, generated by reality's artful and mischievous line-walking. And really, she's saying, look, you know, these producers create these, you know, oversized or exaggerated personas for some of these quote-unquote characters or people that they're portraying, and that the longtime modus operandi of reality television has damaged the show's participants, the TV business, and the public trust in the end.
I mean, how is that?
Well, I think...
How have they damaged the show's participants?
Well, let's certainly
because
with Russell Armstrong...
Because this particular guy committed suicide? We don't know whether or not he would have if he hadn't been on the show. How have they damaged the TV business? The TV business flourishes. Reality television is an incredibly lucrative part of the TV business. How have they damaged the public trust? The public doesn't trust the shows anymore. They don't want to watch Project Runway because they found out the show's being edited. I think they're fine with that.
Well, I think that's a competition show. You know, Project Runway or any of these, you know, singing shows or talent shows.
It's a different type of reality
show. It's a different type of reality show. So I think these...
But it involves nobodies who go on to Project Runway hoping to achieve fame and fortune and have the pressure and crucible of being on television and succeeding or flaming out. So there's just the same pressure for somebody appearing on Project Runway to be a designer as there is for someone on Real Housewives who just wants to become famous for being herself.
Yeah, I mean, look, the public trust, you know, I think the public trust is more at risk.
Has anybody said that the producers of The Real Housewives were responsible for this man's death? Did they see that he was mentally unbalanced and possibly suicidal and failed to act? Is there any evidence of that? Has anybody said that he gave out a cry for help and they ignored it? They thought, this makes good TV. Let's not help this guy and let him spiral down into despair. I haven't had anybody you know, imply this at all. All I know is the guy was on the television show and he committed suicide. You know what? Actors commit suicide too. Music people commit suicide too. What needs to change on reality television to protect these people? What she suggests are several things. One, these people need to get clear compensation.
Well, they are compensated,
I think.
They
are compensated. Yeah. I don't know what she means. She wants us to know what their salaries are. Maybe that's what she means. Two, she says the people who appear on reality television need to get training in a performance before appearing on air, which I guess means have an acting coach. I don't know how that would change anything.
I would agree with you on that. I mean, so what? They go to Lee Strasberg for 3 months.
And she says the shows need to be flagged as fiction.
Well,
they can't pretend it's reality television anymore. They have to let people know this is all fake.
Well, that's an interesting little tidbit that she kind of lays out there, because she writes that viewers pass judgment on these characters that they watch on reality television the same way that they pass judgment on characters in fiction, like, you know, The Sopranos or anything like that. And did you watch the first Apprentice, the first season of Apprentice?
Yes.
I guess she starts naming some of these different reality stars: Bethany Frankel, Camille Grammer, Russell Armstrong, and then she mentions Omarosa. And I thought, you know what? They did kind of create a character out of her that probably is not real.
And how many times has Omarosa been back on television?
She's profited from it. So I totally agree with you. She has profited from that persona that was created either with her consent, without her consent, or for her.
She's been back on shows done by him. She's got a documentary series called The Ultimate Merger that she's appearing in as herself in this year. It's called Donald J. Trump Presents The Ultimate Merger, and Omarosa's appearing on it. She seems comfortable with it.
Right, so she is a little star from The Apprentice who, even though she was the villain during that first season, she wound up profiting from it.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I don't know what her bank account's like, but yeah.
Well, yeah, okay. Well, that's true. You know, but here's one of the reasons that I don't think the TV industry will ever do this. The WGA, for some time now, at least a certain group of writers within the WGA, has been petitioning the networks and the studios to effectively make these producers on these shows writers, because they are all writers that are forced to be quote-unquote producers because they don't
want to pay them writing.
They don't want to pay, that's right, all the pension and welfare funds, and they don't want to have to pay union rates on these shows. And if they call it fiction, then all of a sudden those producers who are really writers actually become writers. So you'll never see them call it fiction, because that would just, you know, it would cost too much money to do it.
But the backroom contracts are very different from what the show is. You may want to not admit that there are writers on American Idol providing lines for the judges, but that doesn't change the show, that it's a talent contest and a game show. It's not a drama. It's not a fictional series. It's not The Sopranos. And Jersey Shore, whatever it is, it ain't, you know, The Good Wife. It just isn't. It's a different thing. It's a reality show. It's not even quite a hybrid like The Hills. It's more of a reality show than, you know, it's a documentary series. It's not real life. No, every time you put it in a camera in a room, you're altering reality. But they're not even striving for the, you know, Frederick Weissman type reality of a documentary film. It's a silly, goofy TV show showing the fake, quote unquote, real lives of people.
Yeah,
it's, I guess, not. It's not The Good Wife. It's not Law and Order. It's not. It's not even close. It's a different thing. No matter what you're paying the writers or the producers or the directors, no matter how you coach the people and have people on staff to help them, it's not fiction.
Maybe they should just put "real" in quotes, and that'll okay. That'll change everything. But now you're bringing up all of these kind of talent shows. Well, a talent show called Dancing with the Stars, Michael. I think you've watched this show in the past. Am I wrong about that, or was that Karen Woodward, one of our former hosts, that watched it?
I've never really watched it. No, okay. I mean, I've seen episodes, but I don't watch it regularly.
Well, they announced their contestants for, is it season 13? I believe it is season 13. And there was a bit of controversy over the fact that Chaz Bono, or Bono, is joining the show this week, and I guess as one of the contestants, as one of the celebrities.
That's right. And of course, Chaz Bono is a transgender person, came out as a lesbian when Chaz was a girl, and then finally realized or came to the realization that he was always meant to be a man, had the gender identity switch, had the surgery, and is now a man, is dancing on the show as a male contestant.
That's right. They said that, you know, the mere fact that he was selected to appear on Dancing with the Stars and will be dancing with a woman made him one of the most high, well, one of the highest profile transgendered people in the world. Well,
absolutely. And of course, if you had gone to the ABC website, you'd see a lot of comments about every time they announced the new batch of contestants, who they like, who they don't. And there were a lot of comments about Chaz, and a fair number of them were negative and, you know, impolite and rude.
That's right. And Cher came out and was blasting those comments. And she, you know, it really does speak to, you know, if they vote, I almost said Sonny Bono, Chaz Bono off the show, you know, whether people are comfortable with watching a transgender person on television, or whether it shows whether they're bigoted or not, I guess is where I was headed.
Or maybe it shows whether Chaz isn't a very good dancer.
It could, yes.
Not exactly a small person. Who knows how light on the feet he is. But you know what? Mission accomplished for the producers.
Yeah, they got, I mean, we're talking about it. It was all over the news last week. So if they were looking to let people know that the show was starting up again, congratulations.
Right. And Chaz is a celebrity, has been all his life as the child of Cher and Sonny Bono. So he's a perfectly valid contestant on the show. I don't think they're trafficking in any cheap theatrics by using him. It's not like they've chosen some criminal or a child, you know, they're choosing a person who's transgendered. They knew it would get attention, but it's a perfectly valid choice and shows our changing times. And I say all credit to them. I hope he does well.
Well, now, speaking of changing times, I note that you have some news from the publishing industry. What is this news? It looks like it's about Random House.
It's interesting. The book is not dead yet. The physical print book isn't dead. Random House had a great first half of the year with profits. Profits are surging thanks to strong digital sales. They point out that some 20% of their revenue comes from digital sales now. So you would think they'd be talking about how great they've transitioned and they're adapting to the changing world. But instead, they seem a little defensive and want to make sure people know that the print book isn't going anywhere. And they've said, hey, you know what? One of our big successes was Unbroken, the nonfiction blockbuster by Laura Hillenbrand.
Very good book, I might add. Very good book.
It is a very good book. My sister loves it. Makes everybody read it. I read it. I like Laura Hillenbrand. I interviewed her for Seabiscuit. I'm very happy that, you know, she's able to come out with this book. It did terrifically well. It sold more than 1 million physical copies. And I thought, why are they distinguishing between physical and why don't they just say what it sold overall? But they're trying to make a point. People still want to read print books. It also sold an extra 650,000 copies in digital. And you know how astonishing that is?
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I mean, almost half of its sales came digitally. When you think about it, there aren't that many Kindles and e-readers out there yet. So the amount of books that sell 30, 40, 50% or more in digital, it's really astonishing. And it's just going to keep exploding. But they also said they had a big blockbuster with the new George R.R. Martin book, which is based, you know, which is the basis for the HBO series Game of Thrones. It was a big hit. They came out with another 4 million copies of the first four books in this series, which is called A Song of Ice and Fire. They're saying, hey, look, people want to read print books. Here's the quote from Random Group publisher and president Gina Centrello. She told Publishers Weekly, in this time of explosive growth in ebook sales, the mega success of Unbroken in hardcover clearly underscores that demand for print editions of great reads is still enormous. What I want to know is, why are they banging the drum for print books? It's either one, because they want to keep getting as many sales as they can out of it. They don't want it to disappear forever as quickly as possible. Just like you didn't want cassettes and LPs to get overwhelmed by cassettes or CDs or digital copy. You want to make sure people know it's going to be around, you can buy it. And their revenue, I think their profit margins are definitely better on hardcover. So I think they're just trying to say, hey, don't worry. People are buying physical books. We want you to buy books. And they're getting a little freaked out because, of course, the number two, you know, bookstore chain in the country just shut down.
I think that has a lot to do with it. And and also, let's face it, the second you move to a digital world, it becomes a lot easier to market and distribute books, just like it's easier to market and distribute, you know, MP3s or, you know, movie streaming, you know, files. It's much easier. The barrier to entry is gone for publishers, and that's, I think, one of the reasons they don't mind print books.
Right, because you can't make movies. You can't make a $200 million movie. You can't compete with, you know, John Carter of Mars. You can compete with a book.
That's right.
And they are a little worried. USA Today pointed out that there were a string of self-published ebooks on their bestseller list, and, you know, that's just going to continue to grow. But still, publishers as gatekeepers for great books will still be really important. Even if you're buying books digitally, they're smart to make them available. They're smart to make them cheap. They're smart to be in the game, unlike the music business, which fought it fiercely. They did not want anyone to get an MP3 of anything, and they paid the price. And I think the book industry is doing a much better job. And that's why you're seeing a lot more tablets and e-readers coming out. Sony announced two more tablets. They have one coming out this month called the Tablet S. It's going to be like $500 to $600. They're putting out a new edition of their e-reader. They're determined to make that work. It's going to be designed.
I don't know why.
It's going to cost $150 and be designed especially to work with libraries, because all libraries now are going to start loaning out books wirelessly. And the Amazon tablet, of course, is due out in October. There's a 7-inch version coming out now, and that's clearly going to compete with the Barnes & Noble Nook. And then there's going to be a 10-inch version coming out early next year. Everyone expects them to sell it at a loss. Everybody thinks the only way to compete with the iPad is to be selling it for a lot less.
Well, yes, I think that's absolutely true. It was proven, at least here in North America, with the HP touchpad when they couldn't get rid of that thing. They couldn't sell it, so HP announced, we're not going to make it anymore after 48 days on the market. So they lowered the price to $99, and people lined up around the block to get this thing, which effectively was obsolete technology.
Exactly. Well, and the Kindle. Kindle has competed very well. It's not a full tablet. It's just an e-reader, but it does its job very well. It's very cheap. It's very thin and small. A lot of people have tablets and e-readers or just an e-reader like the Kindle. And one thing that the difference is between Apple and Amazon is Apple is in the Razer business and Amazon is in the Razer Blade business.
That's right.
Apple uses content like music and movies and books to sell hardware like the iPad. That's why they cost so much. That's where they make their money. Whereas Amazon is in the Razer Blade business. They want to give you the Kindle, give you the tablet for as little money as possible, or even lose money to get you to buy books and music and digital movies and use them on their devices. And that way they make money every time you buy a new book.
I have to say their Amazon Prime program, which gives you free shipping, free 2-day shipping, is...
And streaming stuff, right?
You and get streaming. Yeah. I mean, it is brilliant because now before I buy anything, I think, well, how much is it on Amazon? Because if it's cheaper, I'll just buy it through there and I'll get it in 2 days.
And one thought is that I'm not sure if it's for the 7-inch tablet that's due out in October or the 10-inch one that comes out early next year, but people are saying that Amazon might be offering at least like a first year free on Amazon Prime for people who buy the tablet. So not only will it cost, say, $300 or $400 as opposed to $600 or $700 for an iPad, but you'll get free Amazon Prime and access to all their streaming movies and music and TV.
I think that's just such a horrible idea. I'm going to write right now to Jeff Bezos and tell him, you know, he shouldn't be giving stuff away. But now I'm a little confused. You're saying that this news was either hyped by the publishing industry? Is it a big deal, this news, or is it not worth mentioning? I'm a little confused.
I think it's a big whoop that The Unbroken sold a million copies in print. I think it's a big deal that it sold 650,000 copies in digital. That's where the news is to me.
Well, it almost sounds like you want us to move along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them.
I do. Let's go.
Okay, well, our first story this week, Billy Crystal? Who's that? When Billy Crystal said he had the yen to host the Oscars again, it seemed like a no-brainer for the people involved in next year's telecast to jump on the offer pronto. Instead, they've announced Eddie Murphy will be the host of the 84th Annual Academy Awards. Murphy is a Hollywood veteran who notably stormed out of the place after he didn't win the Best Supporting Actor Oscar for his work on Dreamgirls, something that doesn't endear you necessarily to the Academy. He lost to Alan Arkin for Little Miss Sunshine, by the way. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal because I love the Oscars. It's a big deal for Eddie Murphy. He has a big movie coming out in November, co-starring Ben Stiller, called...
Tower Heist.
And who directed that? Huh. Oh, it was Brett Ratner, who is also producing the Academy Awards. He also has a movie coming out in January or February on DreamWorks. You know, he's never really gone away. I mean, even as recently as 2 or 3 years ago, he had Norbit, which made a good amount of money around the world. But his movies that have made a lot of money have been kind of low rent. You know, Nutty Professor 2, Norbit, not great films. He hasn't had a really popular and critical success as a star in quite a while. It's been a long time since Beverly Hills Cop, that's for sure. Dreamgirls was a great moment turnaround for him. He hasn't capitalized on that with other dramatic roles.
What about Shrek? I mean...
Well, I don't count the animated movies.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I should. He's a big draw for those films. He's very funny in Shrek. People like them. I don't at all. But, you know, more power to him. He's funny in them. He does good voice work. No, he's been in a couple different animated films. But, you know, he's had success consistently over the years. But he definitely could look for some real adding some luster to his star power. And it's a great choice. One, it lets the Oscars be their Oscars. You know, if they chose Billy Crystal, it would just be compared to Oscars in the past. It's perfect for Eddie Murphy. Now you want to tune in just to see how he does.
That's right.
You know, forget, you weren't tuning in to see how James Franco does. I was, but most people weren't. But Eddie Murphy, he's still a big name. And so people say, they don't care what movies are nominated. They want to see, is he going to say something outrageous? Is he going to say something offensive? Will he be classy? Will he be dull? What's he going to do? I can't wait to see. So that'll be a good draw.
It's kind of like stunt casting in a way.
Right, right. It's great. It makes the show the story rather than the movies that are being nominated, which is important if you want to get ratings for the show. And, you know, he's done a lot of live television. He's done stand-up. He's, you know, he's improvised all his life. So he'll be a natural at hosting. Whether he'll have this proper balance between a little, you know, needling in the ribs and respectfulness, it'll be fun to see. It'll be interesting.
Well, speaking of live television and producing live television, Dick Ebersol is back, proving that if there's money to be made, any bad blood can be washed out. NBC and Dick Ebersol are back in business. After decades of legendary work, Ebersol was dumped by Comcast when the new owners of NBC couldn't come to financial terms with the sports producer, but now he's back at the network as a consultant. He'll be advising NBC on football and the Olympics and other big-ticket events, and everyone is making nice. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal. I have a soft spot for Dick Ebersol. He's just a legendary sports producer. He's done such great work over the years. It was a shame how he was dumped by NBC. Now it's a few months later and he's coming back. You know, he's clearly at the tail end of his career. He's quite advanced in age. He wasn't going to start over anywhere else. So I think it seemed like a good idea for everyone. Why not use his pool of knowledge, give him money? You know, he's not going to be consumed day and night with it, but he'll be able to contribute in a positive way. Everybody wins.
Well, sometimes bad blood remains bad blood. Investor Carl Icahn is ending his bitter 3-year fight to gain control of Lionsgate. The company is behind the Tyler Perry franchise, all of his franchises, really, Mad Men, and the upcoming film trilogy, The Hunger Games. But Icahn saw a poorly run company and tried to gain control. He owns 33% of the company, but saw the cost of continuing the fight as prohibitive, especially with Lionsgate trading at $7.52, 2 pennies more than his top price, more than the top price Icahn had offered per share in the past. Everyone is dropping lawsuits aimed at the other side and walking away. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I say it's a big whoop. It's sort of wound down after 3 years. It's a shame for the lawyers. I think they're the only losers out of this.
Right.
Because... I'm not sure actually whether he's making money on this or not. I'm not sure when he bought in or how much his stake cost him. That would be interesting for me to know. I wasn't able to find that out quickly. You know, it wasn't working. He couldn't make it happen. He's moved on.
I think he is making money because he's keeping 1.5 million shares out of all of his shares for quote-unquote tax purposes, for tax reasons, which means that he wants it to be a long-term capital gain, and the only way to do that is to hold on to some of the shares.
There you go.
The truth is out there, but is a third X-Files movie out there as well? Gillian Anderson is game, having established herself on TV and film and smart indie movies like The Last King of Scotland and The House of Mirth, as well as hit miniseries like Bleak House, not to mention acclaimed performances in the theater. Anderson is ready for more spookiness. The last X-Files movie in 2008 grossed $70 million worldwide on a $30 million budget. She says that there's talk of a third film, but doesn't know any more than that. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Classic big whoop. She was at the premiere of a British film called Johnny English. It's a spoof of the James Bond film starring Rowan Atkinson. They said, hey, do you want to make another X-Files movie? And she said, sure, I'd be happy to make another X-Files movie. Don't know anything about one, but I'd love to. So it's something asked on a red carpet that people turn into a news story. It's a non-story. Nothing's happening with it. Big whoop.
And so we've turned it into a big deal or big whoop piece here.
Yes, but we showed people why it's a big whoop.
That's right. Well, do you want some FaceTime with Oprah?
Hell yes.
Well, then head to Facebook. The mogul and TV talent is looking to generate interest in her OWN cable channel, or OWN, and she will give a live chat on Facebook Thursday, September 8th. She joins Obama and former President George W. Bush as figures who've appeared on Facebook as interviewees. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal in the sense of it's interesting how Facebook is trying to create original content like this. The whole idea of the site is that the people create their own original content. You know, their social media, they post, hey, I went to the store. Hey, here's pictures of my kids. But Facebook still feels the need to generate Uber content, you know, for the site to keep people coming back there. It just shows them not wanting to leave any stone unturned, I think, as far as keeping the website important and viable to people.
I don't understand why they want to create German content. It's, you know, it's a joke about the word use of Uber. Laugh later. Well, speaking of Facebook, they're moving ever closer to launching a music service linked into the social media website. The LA Times reports that it's likely Facebook will announce the new feature on September 22nd at its F8 conference. It's expected to provide a platform for Spotify or Pandora to reach out to listeners. Is that a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, you have to see the details. I think it's a big deal because they still have, you know, 800 million people or whatever, and Spotify and Pandora can certainly use another platform. You know, the music thing is changing so fast with all the music in the cloud and Amazon and iTunes and everybody offering all these new services. I think Facebook is, you know, they see Google Plus getting 30, 40 million people in the blink of an eye. And they think, gee, are we that safe? So keep adding to what you do. As long as it makes sense and is integrated well, it can be a big positive.
Konnichiwa, Hulu. Japan is saying hello to the online streaming video service, which has just launched in that country. The first month is free, but after that, you'll have to subscribe to get any access at all to the programming, like US TV shows and movies. CBS is on board with Hulu in Japan, the first time it's partnered with Hulu anywhere in the world. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal as much for CBS getting on board with Hulu as it is for them launching in Japan. They want to go worldwide. It makes perfect sense. We'll have to see how successful they are. And I'm interested about whether they're pulling in local programming as well.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested to know whether they're pulling in Japanese programming, but I'm really surprised that CBS is participating because they have not participated in any online streaming activity at all, except on their own website.
Exactly. So it's an interesting development for them.
What's the best way to drum up excitement for a new TV pilot? Show it. That's the decision by Fox, which is debuting its sitcom New Girl online for free, hoping to get the kids talking about the show and tweeting and Facebooking their excitement so more people will show up for the show's debut. You can check it out now on iTunes, and it'll be coming soon to Hulu, probably in Japan, and YouTube and elsewhere. The sitcom stars Zooey Deschanel as a suddenly single gal rooming with three dudes and premieres September 20th. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. More and more people are doing that. They're having sneak previews. They're putting them out online. They're letting you watch them on Hulu or whatever. It's like, why not? You know, it's the pilot episode. You want people to tune in. If people are eager enough to check it out, they'll talk it up to their friends. You know, if you think the show's good, you should do it.
Well, yeah, I think you look at who stars in this TV series. It's Zooey Deschanel, and most of her fans, most of the people who really follow her, are online. And so if you put the content in front of them, they might actually migrate to TV, or at the very least, they'll migrate to their DVRs. But I certainly hope that once the initial episode airs on September 20th, Fox doesn't run away screaming, going, oh, nobody watched it, because a lot of people will probably watch it before the first episode airs on September 20th. How many times can I say September 20th in one sentence?
Well, the other thing is that it sets you up for the second episode. Okay, maybe it doesn't work. Maybe the first episode is a little bit lower because they had the chance to watch it already. They don't need to watch it twice, but that's okay. If they like it, they'll tell their friends to watch the first episode, and you'll see an uptick in the second episode, which is about the best thing in the world you could hope for.
That's right.
But the funny thing about this show is that Damon Wayans Jr. was on the show. He was one of the co-stars on the show, and he's in the pilot episode. But then his series Happy Endings unexpectedly got picked up for another season, and so he has to go back to that show. So they have him like kicked off the show in the second episode and replaced with this other guy, and they're like, oh, they say Damon was just subletting, and the other guy came back and wants his room back, and that's why they explain why this main character is gone in the second episode.
Wasn't Justin Long now the, you know, I'm a Mac, I'm a PC, he's the Mac in that group. I think he's going to be doing a couple episode arc, like a 7-episode arc on that series.
Oh, I hadn't saw that. He's a love interest perhaps for Zooey?
Who knows?
I hope so. We'll have to watch.
Well, speaking of love interests, what's the best way to get a man? Well, if you're singer Sinead O'Connor, I love this story, by the way. If you're singer Sinead O'Connor, why bother with online dating sites when you can just print your desires in a national newspaper? Wittily, but quite serious about wanting a man, O'Connor wrote in The Independent about her desire for a man with stubble who lived in Ireland. Wasn't just wham-bam, but like to snuggle. But let's not forget the wham-bam. Thank you very much. She followed up on her website, also pimping out her two male nannies who are looking for love as well, when not making delightfully rude suggestions to Bob Dylan, that she be his, well, harmonica. Then she moved on to Twitter and made more off-color jokes. Naturally, it got covered in the press and brought her onto talk shows and the like, but no word yet on whether she's landed a date, much less a proper man. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop, of course. It's amusing. I like Sinead O'Connor. It's fun to see her being playful and funny. She's often has such an earnest image and so serious that it was really fun. If you read the article, and we link to it in the show notes, it's just she's serious about wanting a guy, clearly, but it's very funny and joking. You know, it's not like she's, you know, desperately looking for a man. She's having fun with the whole idea, and she talks about things on Twitter like, I must end now as I have a hot date with a banana.
Yeah.
And how inanimate objects start to look really, really good when you've been without a man for a while. This is very funny. I've always liked her a lot, and it's fun to see her in a playful mood.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if we can read this other tweet that she sent out about, let's just say it got her 2,000 followers overnight. Anyway, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, this story could not affect our listeners more, especially our listeners in North America anymore. If, you know, this is really, we could have led with this story. It was a big story this week. Netflix is going to lose its deal with Stars for most of its movies. It's streaming movies.
Most?
Well, it's most valuable streaming movies, I should say. Disney, Sony, etc.
Right. I'm not sure what the percentage of their programming comes from Stars. I mean, I couldn't get good figures on this, so I'm interested in, if you know better than I do, exactly like what percentage of their total, you know, they have 1,000 movies and 300 come from this deal or what? I don't know. Netflix, of course, is downplaying it. They say, yes, we're losing this deal. It's a shame. We like them a lot. But we've been getting all this other programming revenue. We've been bringing in all this other programming from other sources. And they only represent about 10% of our viewing right now for our readers.
Well, there you just stated it. 10%.
No. I'm making that figure up.
Okay.
And they're saying now it's going to drop down. They're claiming now that, oh, this Starz deal, the movies that they provide, that's only about 5% of what people watch on Netflix. That's what they think the trend will be by the end of the year, that before this deal runs out, 95% of what you watch will not be the star stuff, and therefore you won't miss it that much. But the truth is, it's big Disney movies and big Sony movies, and of course people will miss them.
Well, I don't know if I'm going to use the word irony correct here, but certainly coincidentally, this news broke on the very same day that Netflix implemented its two-tiered pricing, or not two tiers, but two different plans. You can either do just streaming or just DVD or both. And if you do both, it's $16. And if you do just DVD or streaming, it's $8 a month. And the very same day that breaks, basically the people who chose streaming are told, guess what? In 6 months, you won't be able to watch any of the Starz content.
Right, but that Starz means nothing to people. You say, all right, you won't have Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. You won't have John Carter of Mars. And maybe in the future, you won't have the Lone Ranger.
Right. Well, that's really what it means because, of course, Starz is, you know, has an output deal with both Disney and Sony. On the news, the stock price dropped about 8%, Netflix's stock price. And let's see, Netflix here, they offered Starz more than $300 million per year to renew the agreement.
And that was about a 100% increase.
That was
not 100%, but 100 times more. They were paying them $30 million a year, right?
Right. So it's 10 times.
Right. So they had this deal locked in before streaming was a big deal for like, I think it was like for 5 years or something. And they had locked them in at like $30 million a year. And Starz was like, sure, why not? You know, extra $30 million bucks can't hurt. And now they're offered $300 million to renew and they say, no, thank you. Because they want to keep the content for themselves and make it available through their own, I guess, Starz to go or Starz everywhere, whatever they're offering.
Yeah, they're a part of TV everywhere. And you're right. I mean, the deal came down to the one really big sticking point was that Starz, the pay cable channel, because they are like HBO, a pay cable, you know, premium channel, they were insistent, Starz was, on so-called tiered pricing, and meaning that they wanted Netflix to charge consumers $8 for streaming, but if you wanted Starz content or, you know, big blockbuster movies, then you had to pay $12. And of course, that money would go back to Starz. Well, if you look at why that might be, Starz makes roughly $7 per subscriber. So for every subscriber that pays $15 to get Starz on their cable at home, Starz will make $7. From the Netflix streaming deal, they were making $1 per Netflix customer. So it really just did not make a lot of sense for them to continue this. As well, they were really pissing off all of their multi-video platform providers. They were pissing off all of the cable companies.
But they weren't making $1 instead of their $7. They were making $1 on top. And they could have added on $2 or $3 since the cost was increasing by 10 times. Somebody who might have been a Starz subscriber might also, you know, subscribe to Netflix. So that's found money. And somebody who subscribes to Netflix might never pay for Starz, like me. I don't pay for Starz. I don't want to. They don't have enough on their cable channel that I want. I don't need to see Camelot.
Right. Well, they said
very little original programming. All they have are the movies. And frankly, they're going to have trouble renewing their movie deals. So the whole issue here is your library. What do you control the rights to? Channels say, you know what? We need original programming because you never know when they're going to pull away the programming that they own. That's the problem with Hulu. That's the problem with Netflix. That's the problem with all these people. That's the problem with Starz. When Disney and Sony say, why are we selling Starz our movies when we should have them on our own channels? Guess what? Starz is going to be stuck with Gods of the Arena and Camelot and Torchwood.
All of their original content.
Yeah, that's what they have as original content. They have got content locked in right now. They may not in the future. Netflix has almost no original content. They claim they've got great original content. People love their content. Nobody goes to Netflix for their original content.
No, they go there because that's where you can watch the content you already know about.
Right. Everybody's crazy if they think they can all have their own little world and get people to pay for it.
Right.
You know, well, there's TV everywhere, Hulu. I mean, at some point, you've got to say, you know what? Be part of Hulu, be part of Netflix, be part of all of them, and get money from all those different areas and let consumers decide where they want to go, as long as you have in the right windows to make sure you protect the original programming that you create.
Well, the Los Angeles Times is insinuating, and by insinuating, I mean writing, that the Netflix agreement did serious damage to Starz's ability to negotiate deals with its distribution and studio partners, so i.e. with Disney and Sony, and with cable companies like Comcast and Time Warner. So that was another reason to maybe, you know, ask for more out of Netflix, and Netflix just wasn't willing to give it. What is Wall Street saying about all of this? Well, you know, it's kind of mixed. Scott Devin from Morgan Stanley says, we believe Netflix is now going through a new phase in which the company is, one, seeing rising content costs. That's
no
brainer.
Joke.
two, increasingly spending on international expansion. And three, approaching law of large numbers in the U.S. I don't know what that means.
I think that means they've gotten about as big as they can get.
Right. And four, the effects of a price increase, which they themselves kind of did to them. Well, they did to themselves. While Netflix is showing financial discipline and it should be able to acquire other content with the money it would have paid to stars, Netflix is also becoming more of a TV distributor than a movie distributor. Is this bad? We don't know. But it is different. While Netflix stated that stars accounted for 8% of streaming hours, there you go, we believe the number is closer to 15%, including Sony content. I think that's very, we were wondering, and sure enough, our friend Scott Divitt from Morgan Stanley lets us know.
Right, and but they also say it's been trending down and it will trend down further even before the deal expires, but who knows. But it's a hard business when your whole business model depends on content other people offer to you.
That's true, yes.
That's the main problem here.
Now, speaking of content that other people offer, I was a guest on a show called Framerate, which is over on the Twit Network, This Week in Tech. You might know Leo Laporte, who runs or is the host of This Week in Tech, and Tom Merritt, who is the host of Tech News Today. I was on the show with Tom Merritt and Brian Brushwood, who are really two very talented, I want to say radio personalities, but really it doesn't matter. They are great on camera and on radio, and they invited me to be a part of Framerate. And we got a piece of listener email addressing that issue. Michael, do you want to read it?
It's about you, but I'll read it. It's to JSR, J. Sperling Reich, directly to you, not even to the show. I'm not even mentioned. It says, Sperling, heard you on Framerate. You kept your end up great. Tom and Brian can steamroll things and overrun a guest.
That is an understatement. They're very good at what they do.
It was because of your show and how good it is that I found theirs. Since so few host shows do as well and cover so much in the entertainment segment, and Tom, Brian, and Leo are real pros, but I can easily say you are among the top 10 podcasters on the web today. Again, great job and glad Showbiz is back from holiday. It's signed RM, I guess?
Rob Masser.
Oh, Rob Masser.
Yes.
Okay, great. And then he says, now he mentions me to catch me on an error. That's what people always do. P.S. On the last Showbiz Sandbox podcast before the break, Michael mentioned The Lone Ranger as a summer blockbuster. Wasn't it scheduled for winter release? And besides the cost and it being a Western, it was releasing up against several other big movies in that short season. Well, thanks for writing in, Rob Masser. Sterling appreciates your comments about his performance on their show and how good this podcast is. We appreciate it. You're right. If I called The Lone Ranger a potential summer blockbuster, I should have called it a tentpole franchise. It was scheduled for December 2012 release. Whether that will still happen if the movie gets made, I don't know. But if I said summer, I was wrong. And thanks for catching that.
Well, and we should say that if you want to correct Michael on any of his of his many flaws,
many mistakes,
or even myself on the one or two I might make every year, feel free to email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You know, you can also call us. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace, or in your RSS reader. There are numerous ways to subscribe, and we hope you do go to iTunes and rate and review our podcast, because that really helps us out. You can find all of those links, as well as links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, on our website. Now, our website is pretty easy. It's showbizsandbox.com. Same name as the podcast, showbizsandbox.com. I've already mentioned how you can call or email us, but you could also follow us. There are links on the website to Twitter. Our Twitter handle or account is twitter.com/showbizsandbox, and our Facebook account is facebook.com/showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael can be found on his website, michaelgiltz.com, and I was thinking I should probably start my own website where I compile all of the writing I do for various outlets, whether it's for Box Office Magazine or Celluloid Junkie, because I like what you're doing there, Michael.
Yeah, you should.
Well, presently, you can find some of my writing on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.